for real movie lovers.
I'm beginning to wonder about that, Alex. I get sometimes a little bit despairing about what's happening, particularly in Hollywood at the moment. You know, in Hollywood right now, if you want to make a comedy, a little thriller, it's going to cost between $16 and $18 million. Now, this is ludicrous, because to get that money back, you're going to have to take something like $50 million, and before anybody starts seeing a penny profit. So therefore, what they have to do is to make these films which appeal to kids, and kids want action. That's all they want. Also Hollywood believes, and the box office take would seem to indicate that Hollywood is right. They want action. They don't want thought.
They don't even want stars, though, do they? They want one-day wonder stars. Or yesterday, no one's heard of him. Today, he's a big star. People like Clark Gable must be burling in their graves.
Ah, well, yes, I expect... Well, you see, what has happened is that the cinema audience today is aged, what, between 12 and 24? So it's constantly changing. And therefore, each new generation that's coming up wants its own stars. So Michael J. Fox is the flavour of the month at the moment. But give him another couple of years, you know, because... All right, he's you look at him, he's actually 25 going on 17. But he's not going to look 17 forever. And one day he's going to move over and someone else is going to come up. You know, Tom Cruise is another flavour of the month at the moment. How long will he last? He'll last as long as his generation is going to the movies. Then they stop going to the movies, another generation comes along and they want their own stars.
What do you think brought about the demise of what might, to, let's just say, older than 25 years people, be seen as the end of movies? Because you actually finish your book by saying that let's hope there is hope, yeah, and that it's not going to be totally surrendered forever to an industry cranking out movies to satisfy, well, youngsters, let's put it that way, because there'll be some listening tonight. What was the beginning of the end?
Do you know, I think it's been put down to all kinds of things. Television bears the brunt of the blame, but this is not really true. You see, 1946, first year after the war, cinema attendances in America were higher than they had ever been. Within a couple of years, they had plummeted by half. And the reason for that was the baby boom. I mean, all these returning servicemen and servicewomen, you know, I think by and large people prefer to make love than make war, and particularly after war they go about making love very enthusiastically. The result of this was that all those people who were going to the movies when they were courting in 1946, by about 1948 had got kids. There was no babysitting industry in those days, so they stopped going to the pictures. Then television came along. Which obviously also helped to destroy the cinema audience. And then there were all kinds of technical things, like the law, which divorced ownership of cinemas from the ownership of the cinemas, the ownership of studios rather from the ownership of the cinemas. So that all helped. And so gradually throughout the 1950s, the audience declined. Then the babysitting boom started. Now that, for a while, brought back the older people into the cinema. What it also meant was that there was money in the pockets of the teenagers, and they wanted to go to the movies too. So then people started making movies for teenagers, and that, I think, is where it all began, 30 years ago.
But something like 10 or 12 years ago was really, if one can use the phrase, the beginning of the big nails in the coffin, when no longer were stars needed, but special effects were what it was all about. When you were writing your book, was there... I think I know the answer from reading the book. Was it a kind of note of despair about the present situation, vis-a-vis all the movies you've seen in the dark days, sitting in the flea pits and so on?
Yeah, there was. The despair is to be found, really, among the people who have tried and still want to try to make adult movies, people like Sidney Lumet and Blake Edwards, and they're the people who are finding it increasingly difficult to get backing for the films they want to make. You don't find the despair among the people who make Top Gun and clean up $180 million and become overnight wealthier than most of us can ever dream of being. These guys don't have any despair, because they're going to make another one like that. But I don't... They're businessmen, and there's a difference, I think, between the businessmen who are cleaning up in Hollywood and the filmmakers who are getting shunted off to one side.
Now, that's the end, or if you like, that's today. Your book on... Hang on a second, Barry. Hello, everybody. As always, at this time of the Monday night, it's my pleasure to bring into the studio your guest for authors. And tonight we've got with us... Well, if you haven't recognised his voice just now, you've just come down from the moon. We have with us Barry Norman. Yes, that's right. The same Barry Norman who sits inside the small box in the corner. Well, he's actually much bigger. He's completely normal in terms of size, anyway. I can go as far as to say that.
Only in size.
Only in size. And tonight we're talking about his latest book, which is called Talking Pictures. It's a BBC publication in association with Hodder and Stoughton. And it's the latest in a long line of books about the movies which Barry has written. The film great... The movie greats, the Hollywood greats. as well as, of course, writing novels. In fact, we were talking just before we came on air tonight about the last time we met, which was all about a plan. Your novel at that time was all about a plan to rear people just to help the daily diet. In other words, eating them. However, we digress. Barry, thank you very much for coming in and joining us this evening.
It's my pleasure.
Talking Pictures annoyed me, I've got to say that, because you did not give enough to the kind of stars and the studios and the stories from the past. In a way, I'm very much saying the trouble with Talking Pictures is it's too short. But it's basically the story, I dare say, from your scripts, at least in part, of a telly series, isn't it?
Well, only in part, Alex, actually, because, as I say at the very beginning of the book, it is incredible how little you can actually say in a 50-minute television documentary. And I think it is, quite honestly, the equivalent of a 3,000-word magazine article, copiously illustrated. Now, the joy of being able to write a book at the same time as doing a series is that you are left with all this marvellous stuff that you want to get into the TV series and you can't. Not because it's not good enough, but because it simply doesn't fit. So then you can take all that stuff and put it into a book. So the chapters in the book, where there are 10 chapters there, it must be at least a 100,000-word book. So you're talking
350
about,
pages.
Yeah, 350 pages.
But having challenged yourself to write a book like this, it is a very, very difficult job, I'm sure, to get the history since, the 1920s up to the present into one book. I mean, there must have been bits you were feeling, gosh, I wish I could expand on that, I wish I could write more about this. But the discipline must have been tremendous.
Well, yeah, you see, I mean, I also try to make clear that I don't pretend this is a history of Hollywood, because you couldn't, as you very rightly say, you couldn't do that in one volume. You need a dozen, 100 maybe, volumes. So what I had to do, and what we've also done in the series, of course, is to look at aspects of Hollywood since the introduction of sound.
Like the coming of sound, the studio system, Hollywood and sex, Hollywood Goes to War, some of the titles of the chapters.
Yeah. And incidentally, this is very timely that you and I should be chatting now, because it was 60 years ago this week that the first Talking Picture opened in New York,
yes.
Jazz singer.
Yes. Despite the resistance of some of the studio chiefs, as you say in the book there, to accepting that, hey, this might just be here to stay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you see, there was reluctance all along, because the jazz scene was actually made by Warner Brothers.
And it wasn't a total talkie anyway, as you tell us. I mean, we've always imagined that...
Just relaxed into silence.
Out. Yes.
Yeah, after a little while, you're just lost for words. But the year before, in 1926, Warner Brothers had made a film called Don Juan, which had the first synchronised soundtrack. But it was only music, no talk. And after that, Sam Warner said to his brother Harry, there were an awful lot of Warners, he said, "You don't forget, we can hear actors talk now." And Harry said, "Who the hell wants to hear actors talk?" Yeah. Sometimes I think the guy had a point. Mm. But so Warners had to go ahead and make the sound picture, because they were in a very dodgy financial state and they needed something, a gimmick, in fact, which is what it was. And the rest of Hollywood thought that this was a gimmick too. And they resisted it for very obvious and in a way, quite sensible reasons. In the first place, it was going to cost an enormous amount of money to convert the studios to making sound films.
All that carpet that had to be taken from the props department.
Taken from the props department, nailed up on the walls while they actually built real soundproof studios. It's going to cost as much money again to convert all the cinemas. And what was going to happen to the backlog of silent pictures? They suddenly felt, you know, they'd invested a lot of money in this, in all these silent pictures, and they had this fear that they're going to be left with all these things sitting on the shelf and nobody ever wanted to see them again. Mm. So there was a big resistance, but the public response to the jazz singer was such that it was quite obvious very quickly that sound was actually here to stay. Mm.
One of the things that people who know the slightest bit about the early comings of sound, I mean, the Jolson stepping forward bit, which will strike them, is the dumping of some great names from the silent days. I mean, for example, you talk in the book about the Hollywood star who was found sleeping in Central Park, the other one who was working in Macy's. I read the book first a few weeks ago, and I happened to be in New York, and when I went into Macy's, I thought, is the ghost still in here? You know, it's like working in Harrods or working in Fraser's in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And also the quotes from people like Douglas Fairbanks Sr. He didn't really want, well, it was son who was talking to you, didn't really want to get involved. His father didn't like it. Presumably his voice wasn't good enough.
I don't know. It's difficult to tell. I think it is quite possible that Fairbanks Sr. simply was not interested in it. I think he'd had a good career. He was well into his 40s when it all came in, and I think he just didn't want to bother with the newfangled stuff. And I don't think he needed the money. So, and perhaps for a while he didn't think it was going to last. And by the time it was obviously going to last, then he was forgotten. But there was some sad. There was the one that I think is the saddest of all was a girl called Dolores Costello. who was glamour puss of the silent screen, sex symbol. Unfortunately, she had a bit of a lisp, and her talking picture career ended when she had to deliver the line, "Murthy, Murthy, have you no sister of your own?" Boom, goodbye, Dolores.
Finished, yeah.
Very sad.
Shame. What's the truth about the John Gilbert story? Because you hint at it, and you say it's rumoured that, and it was fiddled with, and so on. What do you believe?
I'm inclined to believe that Louis B. Mayer deliberately destroyed John Gilbert's career. You know, but the thing is, I don't come down on that side because there is, to be honest, there is no evidence except verbal evidence. And for everybody you talk to who says yes, Mayer destroyed Gilbert, you find somebody else who said no, he certainly wouldn't have done so. But I think he did, and this may seem strange because Gilbert at that time was only about 30, 32. He was the biggest star in the movies, the male star in the movies. He was Greta Garbo's leading man. He was the biggest star in the MGM lot by a long way. But he was also a lot of trouble. He was a drunk. He was a troublemaker. He was not dependable. And he'd also signed a very big contract for a lot of money with MGM. And I think Mayer simply wanted to dump him. And I believe that what happened was that when Gilbert's first film was made, first sound film was made, Mayer had the sound tweaked so that his voice came out shrill and falsetto. If you see the last film, The Captain Loves the Sea, he's got a perfectly normal voice, and very nice voice, in fact. But one of the reasons, and probably as important as any other reason for Mayer doing this, is that Gilbert was going to marry Garbo. And Gilbert turned up, and Mayer turned up, and the guest turned up. The only one who didn't turn up was Garbo. And Gilbert was understandably a bit fretful about this. So he was pacing around, wondering where she was. And Mayer got impatient with him and said, "Ah, what the hell, you've slept with her. Why do you want to marry her?" So Gilbert, won't have a lady's name taken in vain, knocked him down. Now, if you worked at MGM, it was always something of a mistake to knock Louis B. Mayer down, as Gilbert discovered.
Yeah. Of course, Louis B. Mayer eventually got his comeuppance too, didn't he? I
mean, yes, he did. Yeah.
There's a little story you tell it about the Christmas cards.
Yeah, that was very sad because, you know, when he was the head of MGM, he was getting Christmas presents, Christmas cards from everywhere. I think about a year after he'd been booted out of MGM, George Sidney, one of the directors, and one of the very few people who actually kept in touch with him after he'd gone, because in Hollywood nobody likes a loser. And Sidney went round to his house just before Christmas, and Mayer said, "Oh, I'd come in here," and took him into the living room, and there was one Christmas card on the mantelpiece, just one.
One of the things I think people are going to enjoy particularly about the book, I mean, the kind of people who watch your programmes about it, is the way that things they've never thought about are explained. For example, sound, when it first came in, was a static thing. Mm. And then one director had the idea, hey, there's no reason why it has to be static. You can actually move it around.
Yeah. Well, that was it was the camera, of course, first of all. Well, the sound was most definitely static because they used to hide the microphones and flowers and all over the place. You know, that marvellous scene in Singing in the Rain where she's going from side to side. Do you remember that? And the sound is on, then it's off because she can't... doesn't look at the microphone all the time. But the camera was totally static, and it must have been hell being a cameraman, because it was in a kind of box, a glass case, and there'd be three or four people in there, and it had to be in this glass case because the equipment was so sensitive to noise that even the whirring of the camera would have been picked up by the microphone, until Ruben Mamoulian came along and said, you know, that this is ridiculous. Why can't we move the camera? And they said, because it's never been done, you know, which is everybody's answer always to a new idea. And very simply, he said, he got six guys built, I suppose, like Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Or his ex-wife.
yes, that's a lady I wouldn't like to meet in a dark alley. However, we digress again. And he got them to lift this box up, stick it on rollers and push it about. And suddenly movement had been restored to the camera. But the real innovation there was Howard Hughes, you know, the amazing Howard Hughes, who invented the ball bearing in order to make a camera totally mobile without being stuck on rails. And of course, he cleaned up on making the ball bearing. He cleaned up with the cameras as well.
All through the book, there are good examples where people will say, oh, what a shame. I mean, Mamoulian, for example, gave that to the industry, and yet his career was just chopped off. He lasted a long time, but didn't make many movies because he overspent, didn't he?
Well, it wasn't so much that he overspent on this first film, Applause.
I'm thinking of his last film.
Oh, his last one. Yes, I beg your pardon. Yes. Oh, his last. Oh, Cleopatra. Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, to be fair to Mamoulian, it was to a large extent a matter of choice. He didn't make many movies because he actually preferred working in the theatre.
He'd come from the theatre, in fact, when he came up with this idea, didn't he?
And went back to the theatre. Mm. Yeah, yes, because Cleopatra was, until Heaven's Gate, the biggest financial disaster that the industry had ever seen. Mm. And that was the end of Mamoulian's career because he was thrown off it and replaced by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. And boom.
You said by that nobody in Hollywood likes a loser, and yet this is the kind of book, I think, where a lot of people are going to feel very sorry for and identify with the losers, people who were very big and then slid away. Mm. For you, when you were creating the chapters in this, were you conscious of the fact that anybody who likes old movies, particularly on TV, the black and whites and so on, which is still a very large part of our staple diet of television, even turning the pages and reading about what happened to the actors and actresses is going to strike a chord with them? I mean, for example, there's a picture of Eddie Bracken in there.
Oh, yes.
Now, who remembers Eddie Bracken unless you're not so much an old movie buff, but somebody who liked watching them?
Yes. Yeah, oh, that's true. Yeah, but, I mean, the nice thing is that Eddie Bracken is still around. He's still very hale and hearty and fit, and he's doing work in TV, I think. But, yeah, he was that kind of... There was a, you know, there are always gradations of stars, and he was one, a kind of second-rank star, who had a brief vogue and then slowly slid away. Then below those, there are people who have an even briefer vogue and just vanish and never seen again.
You did a lot of work on this, 2 years of researching and talking to stars and people. As you... First of all, did you get anything out of any of them which surprised you? Because you've been a movie buff since... Well, literally, your father was in the business as well, wasn't he? I mean, he goes back as far as that.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by any of the things you learned?
I don't know. It's very hard to say. I think probably not, because you know, having done the research and been helped, let's face it, by a lot of people who did much more in-depth research than I did. I mean, I did a lot of reading around the subject, but simply didn't have time to do all the research. But by the time I went along to talk to people, I had a pretty good idea of what had been going on. So when somebody says to me, is there anything surprising in the book, it's hard for me to say, because it didn't surprise me, but it might well surprise other people.
Mm.
And the thing that I've noticed that has surprised a lot of people is the regulation they had in the 30s, the censorship, about kissing, that you could only kiss for 8 seconds, and both parties had to have their mouths firmly closed and no open-mouth kissing. And that the script girl sat beside the director with a stopwatch as they went into the clinch and counted down 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, out. And at that moment, they had to break apart with their lips still firmly closed together. I mean, that is amazing. I did know about it, you see, but a lot of other people who didn't have found that surprising.
You take big stars like, say, John Wayne, and you like him for what he did, but he was a bit too hawkish for you, wasn't he? I mean, you pick up a lot of these people there, but you still say that, in a sense, the greatest thing that the movies have ever given, and one can almost call it culture, is the Western.
Oh, well, I think it is. It's America's biggest contribution to the cinema. A lot of people say the musical, and there is an argument for that, but the Western could only have come from America, because... I don't think there was anywhere else, certainly not in the civilized world, that had the equivalent of a Wild West in the late 19th century, as America did. And I always, all my life, you know, I have been a sucker for a movie in which, at the end, two men meet on Main Street, you know, and reach for their guns. I mean, absolutely marvellous. And also, I think they're lovely films because they are the modern morality play, or at their best they are. When they were simple, when it was one man up against the crooks, ended up with a showdown, everything could be solved by the discharge of one bullet. You know, there was something, in a kind of way, clean about that.
Good v. evil, white hat v. black hat.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's gone. I think, mind you, people have been saying the Western is dead since about 1928. But I think it shows greater signs of being dead now than ever, because it's, 10, 11 years since the last really great Western, which is The Outlaw Josie Wales. Mm. And there hasn't been a good Western since then.
Another thing which I think people will enjoy getting in detail, because it's one of the chapters, is the politics of Hollywood. Mm. They really stank, didn't they?
Oh, completely, yeah. I mean, that was, I think it's the darkest period in America's history, and most Americans... even fairly right-wing Americans will agree with you now, because this hunting down of the communists in Hollywood. I mean, how on earth, why Hollywood should have been run by communists? You know, if you only had to sit back and think about it, Hollywood is run by bankers. It's run by the
all the more so now, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's always been run by the bankers. I mean, the power in the film industry has always resided in New York with the money men. And the bankers really took over the studios in the Depression, because all of the studios were in deep trouble. Some of them went to the mafia for money. Harry Cohn is said to have gone to the mafia for money to keep Columbia going. But most of the others went to legitimate banks. And so the bankers have controlled the studios ever since. Now, I do not believe that there has ever been a conspiracy of American bankers to overthrow the Constitution and introduce communism. And there certainly wasn't at the time when the House Un-American Activities Committee was digging up communists or suspected communists from out of the woodwork.
McCarthy was in full cry.
And McCarthy, yes, yeah. Although he was after the people in the Pentagon. Yeah. HUAC, House Un-American Activities Committee, concentrated very much more on Hollywood. It's a ludicrous. It's a tragic farce, basically.
Another of the chapters I enjoy very much was Hollywood at War, where directors even wanted to get into shots waving Tommy guns. I think your phrase in the book is much to the concern and the likely danger of his own side.
Oh, that was Daryl Zanuck, yeah. Yeah. Well, they were known as the Hollywood Colonels, these guys, you know, Zanuck and Ford, Houston. Mm. They went off and they made some remarkably good documentaries about the war. But Zanuck was the only one who actually appeared in shot waving a Tommy gun.
Mm. He was still reliving it. I remember reading in the book when Longest Day was being made.
That's right.
Only it was a Tommy gun-sized cigar
was clutching. Yeah, absolutely. I went down there to the Ile de Ré when he was making The Longest Day and on the beach scene there. And there he was with this just as lethal as a Tommy gun, I would think. You know, I wouldn't like him to hit me with it. And I think, yes, reliving the glories of his Tommy gun waving days. But they did very good work, those people. And really, Hollywood should have learned from the documentaries and the experiences of those men. And it didn't, which takes us back to really where we were. One of the reasons also for the decline in cinema audiences, the baby boom, I think, most of all, but equally back in the studios in Hollywood, the second raters had taken over. Mm. The best directors and writers had gone off to do their bit in the war effort.
And a lot of the big stars as well.
And a lot of the big stars. So a lot of second-rate people were making second-rate movies. And they were cleaning up throughout the war years, obviously, because of captive audience of no television. And they thought that they could carry on doing this forever. And that they continued making the same kind of films that they made during the war. Some of them good, some of them not very good. A lot of them just so-so. And I think the audience had grown up much more than the industry realised. You know, I think going through a war must make you grow up.
Barry, thanks for coming in and telling us a little bit about your new book. I'm sure an awful lot of people are going to enjoy it and watch it, at least watch some of it when it appears on the screen. Talking Pictures, The Story of Hollywood. Too short, I say again. Can't get it all into 350 pages. Can I thank you very much and wish you, and of course the BBC, who are publishing it along with Hodder and Stoughton, every success. It's been super having you, Barry. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Alex.